Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, April 13, 2005, and we're here for a public hearing on House Bill 5045, which is the Department of State Lands Budget Bill, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5045. Ms. McGlashan, in stage setting activities, do you have anything for us here?
Madam Chair, members of the Subcommittee, I would just point out that I did distribute some materials to you that the department has provided in response to some questions that came up during their phase one presentation. So if you would like them to go over that, they could. Otherwise, we could get right into phase two, which would start out with
2.2%
of rent. Excuse me, Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services doing the overview of the governor's budget before the director of the department gets into the budget depth.
Well, let's ask the director to come forward and take us through the answers to these questions. And Ms. Pearson, you might want to just get your chair warmed up in anticipation.
The memo dated March 21st, is that the one before you that you're looking
yes.
at? Okay. That has questions.
For the record, if you
Oh,
would.
I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes, Director, Department of State Lands. The memo has questions that were asked regarding wetland mitigation banks, how many acres there are, the historical acreage of wetlands in Oregon, and tidal, saltwater tidal wetlands. We, in terms of how many acres of wetlands there are in Oregon, we really only have a rough estimate at this time. In the 1980s, the estimate was about 1.4 million acres, or about 2.2% of the total land base. Historically, again, we only have really rough estimates, but then it was thought to be about 2.3 million acres. Thus, the loss has been about 38%. In the wetland in the Willamette Valley, that's been higher at about 57% loss. We also have information on the second page relating to the number of acres in mitigation bank and bank ownership. There are currently about 634 acres in mitigation.
Can I ask a clarification question on the wetlands issues? You've got wetlands acreage that for 1780. How was that number derived?
I'm not exactly sure. I think at the time there were maps and there were surveys that were done that would note where wetland areas were or swampland areas. But again, it was very rough. They obviously didn't have aerial photography at the time or as precise measurements, and that's why we try to preface in there that that was that's a very, very rough estimate.
Representative Krieger.
Wasn't it 1804 or 6 when Lewis and Clark came out?
Three.
Oh,
I don't know.
That should be 1880, my guess. I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed.
Because it looks,
yeah,
to me
it
like.
It should be.
I don't know who is here other than somebody passing by on a ship offshore.
Yeah, I think it would be awfully hard. That has to be the 1880s. I'm sorry.
So we're talking about the 1880s?
Yes.
Okay. And then, so where is State of the Environment? The data around the historical wetland loss in the Willamette Valley, where is that derived from? I mean, what does historical mean? It says Oregon State of the Environment Report 2000 for the citation.
If you would like, since I'm not an expert on where these numbers came from, I could have Janet Moreland, who is our state expert, and if she's in the office today, I could have her come so that she's here for the hearing.
Okay.
And then she'd be able to respond to the questions much better than I.
Okay.
Just
One other question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If you have, it appears you're showing a disproportionate loss in Willamette Valley, are you therefore having any stricter restrictions on those areas where you've had higher loss to preserve what little you have left?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, we don't have more restrictions for the Willamette Valley than we, because we apply the removal fill law evenly. The Willamette Valley, I think, was disproportionately affected because of the number of rivers and wetlands that there were here to begin with, and that and the wetlands often were some of the best acreage for farming, and so they were transformed from wetlands to farming.
When did Oregon adopt regulations around wetlands mitigation?
I believe the first regulations occurred in 1989. On wetlands, the removal fill law was 1967, I believe. I could double check on those dates.
I'm just curious about, in the first question, the second answer says that between 1982 and 1994, there was a loss of 272,952 acres for that time interval. And I'm wondering if that reflects the mitigation that, you know, the 2-to-1 mitigation and the 3-to-1 mitigation and the 1-to-1 mitigation, or whether that just reflects the impacted wetland, not the restored wetland.
I think that would be best if Janet were to be able to come, she could answer that more exactly, to know whether or not that's net of mitigation or not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crow.
Thank you. Those numbers don't add up. I'm sorry. That's 12 years, over a 12-year period. If you do 12 times 546 acres a year, it doesn't come out to 272,000 acres. The math isn't right. You better do the math better. And second thing, Madam Chair, is when you talk about the definition of wetlands, what are you referring to in terms of, are you using the federal definition of wetlands, or does Oregon have a different definition of wetlands in statute?
We have a definition of wetlands in terms of the hydrology and the plants. It's very similar to the federal definition.
Okay, so one more question, Madam Chair.
I think there's a misplaced decimal point.
22,000 instead of
22,000. When you take the 272,952 and divide it by 12. Oh, wait a minute. No,
you times it times 12. You times 546 times 12, and I don't think that comes out 272,000.
We will double check those numbers and get back to you.
In fact, you might do that for all your acres calculations.
We will double check all of that and make sure.
There we go, 6,552. Yes. That's better. One more question, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Under the federal definition of wetlands, basically, most of the valley floor, even today, a lot of the farmland that I've farmed for most of my life and been around holds water for more than 7 days a year, just by virtue of the rain that we get in the valley here and how it puddles and pools. So when you talk about the loss of wetlands acres, I would urge the committee and the department to keep that in perspective, because a wetlands that has water on it stands for 7 days out of the year really isn't much of a wetlands, but yet that's the federal definition, unless they've changed it. So it seems to me that when you talk about the loss of wetlands, it looks really bad, but in practical terms, is it? That's the question.
And that, I think, would be best if Janet could come. She could tell you, because it depends on the functions of the wetlands you're talking about. You know, and wetlands vary in terms of the kind of functions that they provide, and that affects what the magnitude of the loss means. Representative Schaffler has a question.
I don't expect you to have this answer, but do you have anywhere back in your files how many farmland acres have a tile drainage system put in them? Do you have any idea? If you do, I'd be interested and curious to see that.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, will have to check on that. I don't know.
I have the same related questions around the saltwater wetlands, where the information came from in the 1870s, and whether this includes the mitigated acreage, too.
Okay. So maybe if we could defer some of these questions until she gets here, that would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. When you come back, I'd like to have a really tight definition of what a wetland is. I appreciate your comments, and I'd like to see what there must be more than just, I mean, that may be essence of it. It is 7 days of water staying on a piece of land, but I'd like to see what the federal definition is and see that's
the problem. And I think, Steve, can you talk through what the definition is for federal and state?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Field Operations for the Department of State Lands. The definition that we use for a wetland is the same definition that the Corps of Engineers uses in their 1987 delineation manual. And that definition sounds somewhat simple but fairly complex. But it really boils down to we have three criteria that a piece of ground must meet to be classified a wetland. One is it must have hydrology, it must have hydrophytic plant life, and it must have hydric soils. The key is it must have a hydric soil to be classified as a wetland, because that is a wetland soil, a soil that is capable of holding moisture plus allowing a wetland plant to exist on site. The absence of hydrology or plants is where it gets more complicated. A land that has been disturbed, filled in previously, are more difficult to determine if they're actually wetlands. A lot of it's based on historical data and historical aerial photography. So in a nutshell, that's what it is. That's the definition of a wetland.
So how can you apply that definition to maps that were drawn up in the 1870s?
I can't answer that question.
Janet would probably be able to answer that, because she worked on the Oregon environmental report.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bates?
A site I study here by in 1990 by Gall. The 13. How long is that report?
What are you looking at?
They cite
the citation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Page 3 on their handout. Could we have an executive summary of that? Because I think your question is appropriate. How can you?
Yeah. I would agree.
If we have an executive look at that, I'd appreciate it. That'll give me an idea of what you talked about, the actual loss was in the last 100 years, where we're at now, what a wetland is. I'm new. I don't know this stuff. I spend a lot of time outdoors. When I walk across a piece of land, I can tell you what I think is a wetland, what isn't. But that doesn't mean that meets the legal criteria for it. I spend a lot of time fishing and hiking, and I know when I'm in a swamp, I'm commonly there. Okay? to fit this actual legal definition is different. I'd like to see some information on that if I could. Thank you.
Let's continue and talk about mitigation things.
Exposed flesh. If you have fine mosquitoes for spirits, very wetlands. Okay. We come up with our own definition of the chair. We cited it on June 15th of any given year. If you expose 1 square inch of yourself to the air in a wetland, you'll have 5 mosquitoes on it. That should be the definition. Okay. Can you go with that?
A lot of people buy that.
Yeah. Not going to buy that, are you? I can tell.
I'm not going.
Well, it was a thought. I was
still working on it in the Senate.
Moving ahead here.
Yeah.
Keep things simple, you know.
We have questions pertaining to acres and mitigation bins.
We have 634 acres in mitigation banks. There are 11 active and inactive banks. There's a difference some of the credits have been sold and some of the banks phase in their development. Those credits are dependent upon the agreement that is entered into with when they have their mitigation bank instrument signed.
And how long has there been a program in place to allow mitigation banks to be established?
Nobody
enters the bank.
1997
or
98. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Question?
Yes.
Is that bank, like, are Acres moving in and out of all? The number just seems small to me. Are the acres moving in and out of that all the time, being traded and moved, and that's it. So the number of acres that have already gone through the banks is large, or?
Well, the mitigation banks, let's see, they change depending on whether or not they're adding more acreage to the banks. And the acreage that's available for credits change depending on how many have been sold.
But what I understand this to be saying, and please correct me if my perceptions are not right, that the total acreage that is the total acreage that's currently in mitigation banks is 634, or is that the total acreage that has ever been in mitigation banks?
I think it's the total. All the banks.
Members of committee, Steve Purchase, assistant director. That is the total acres that were available in the mitigation bank at any one time. As the credits are sold, the number of acres available goes down. As new banks come in, the number of acres go up, and it's very fluid as it goes up and down.
Okay.
But that was how many acres were available at the time.
They took this picture. Okay.
It doesn't mean that those are the credits available. That's just the number of acres.
No, I think you delineate in here that the credit that's available is actually 392.
That's correct.
But the total number of acres that have ever been involved in mitigation banks, give us a ballpark number on that.
634.
So that's all there's ever been in all the years of the program.
That's correct.
What stands in the way of mitigation banks coming into being more with more volume than these numbers indicate?
Madam Chair, members, there are two things I think that affect the mitigation bank. One is it is a fairly new program. It's only been around about 8 years now. In that program, it takes time for the market to develop and for landowners to go through a process that would allow them to sell a wetland credit both on the state program and the federal program. And the way the state statute is set up, our wetland mitigation banking instrument has to be approved by both the Department of State Lands and the Corps of Engineers. So when that bank can sell a credit for a mitigation or for some wetland loss, it has to meet the federal test as well as the state test. And that's taken some time to get that established through the system.
So part of the problem then is that the regulations involved in what actually mitigation banks are and how you do them and what they have to look like have been taken a long time to form?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that the regulations are the problem. I think the bigger problem is developing a market for an individual to be able to sell their mitigation credits. It is a very upfront intensive process you have to go through to get your bank established to meet this state criteria and the federal criteria. And then you have to wait for someone within your service area to come to you and say, I want to buy a credit in your mitigation bank from you. A lot of landowners are simply not willing to take that risk to tie up land and the value establishing the mitigation bank, waiting for someone to come to them and to get a credit sold. It's very much market-driven between private parties.
So this 634 acres represents 11 banks?
That's correct.
And where geographically, where are they located?
Ballpark, mostly on the west side of the state, in the Willamette Valley area.
So they're located in a place where most of the economic churn is in the state.
That's correct.
Yes.
Correct.
It just seems to me that, I mean, the program's been on the ground from 97 to 98, so, you know, that's a pretty long time. If you were a small business, after that amount of time, you would have either gone bankrupt or become pretty well established.
I think one of the good news last session, House Bill, I think it was 2899 passed, and House Bill 2899 has provided more incentives and made it easier for mitigation banks. As a result, I think we're having three or four more banks coming on soon and increased use of those mitigation banks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there opportunities for a individual who is going to need wetlands mitigation? Are there opportunities for them to achieve wetlands mitigation without having to buy a credit from a bank? So, in other words, could they go out and create their own wetlands somewhere else on the property to replace whatever they're going to do, or somewhere else, or can they do it with a private person? And then how does that process work? Do you still have to get signed off by, I would assume, the Corps and yourselves?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, the answer to your question is if you go through an individual permit process and you have a wetland impact that requires mitigation, you have a number of options available to you as the applicant. You can do that mitigation on site yourself and deal with it. You can do mitigation on someone else's property as long as you have their permission to do that, and that would satisfy our requirements. You can buy a credit from the bank. You can pay into a mitigation into our wetland revolving fund, which is established by the legislature about the same time they did the mitigation banks. You have a number of other options available to you to mitigate for that loss. The one thing I would add about the mitigation banks, just to make sure I articulate this to the committee, we think it's a success because it may have been an infant program getting off to a fairly difficult start because trying to meet the federal criteria as well as the state criteria. But the fact that there are so many new banks being proposed right now tells me that it's starting to catch on in the state of Oregon as a viable mm-hmm. real estate venture that people are willing to invest in.
How many are being proposed right now?
I think we have seven all total, counting the three ODOT, which are multi-species mitigation banks. But, you know, I got to believe in my heart that it's taken some a while to take some root, but it really has in our state. And I think that's a credit to those folks who have been willing to, you know, kind of the forerunners, if you will, who had to bear the cost to get the thing up and running.
We're
I believe you said that three of them were proposed by ODOT.
ODOT is doing a multi-species mitigation bank. More than just wetland mitigation, they're trying to do a bank that will allow them to mitigate for everything from a Oregon chub to a steelhead to wetland loss to you name it, all the different things that they have to do in the performance of their OTIA bridge projects to be able to mitigate for those losses.
It's pretty ambitious.
And the other four, are they private sector?
They are private.
Yes.
Madam Chair, another question. Thank you. For wetlands mitigation, typically, do you need to be in a what's defined as a service area? So, in other words, if you're in Portland, somewhere in the Portland metro area, and you need to mitigate, do you need to do it somewhere close to the Portland area, or can you buy wetlands mitigation credits down in Almsville or Eugene, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, you have to buy service credits within your service areas established by the statute.
Yes, something else.
How much the cost of your agency can you attribute to the mitigation bank? Is that possible to do that?
There's a mitigation bank?
We have.
I'm asking her too.
We have one position that is focused on mitigation banks and working with the mitigation banks, but she does more than just the mitigation banks. So I don't know, maybe half of her position or not even that
probably
much.
Probably one full-time equivalent because you've got a lot of other folks on staff who may work on a mitigation issue related to purchasing a credit from an established bank, as well as trying to work on establishing new banks. The one position Anne's referring to is there really to help establish new banks and get them up and running. And it's taken us some while to get the Corps to understand that's something we really need to do in this state, and to kind of get them on board with the mitigation bank concept. So,
because it's important if you're a developer and you want to purchase a mitigation credit, you want to also make sure that it not only satisfies on a state level but on the federal level. And so that's taken more work to try to make sure that that's the case.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What's the cost to buy an acre of mitigation in the bank?
45 to 50,000.
53,000 is what you guys spent?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the law that passed last session requires the department to go out to the mitigation bankers and query them as to what their cost is per acre that they would sell a credit for. And that credit right now is $50,000.
Great.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you buy a credit or you pay into our wetland revolving fund, the state legislature requires us to charge the same rate per credit as the private bankers get. That's established last session.
Now you can buy fractions of a bank, or fractions of a credit too. So if you only need like an eighth of an acre, you could do that. And that's often, usually they people are buying a fraction of an acre.
But is it not correct that most mitigation requires more acreage to be credited than you're actually, the wetlands you're actually taking out of use? You have to restore more acreage than that in order to comply.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. If you impact a wetland, you have three alternatives under state rules today, which is you can create, restore, or enhance. Each of those have a different ratio that go with them. Create is 1-to-1, restoration is 2-to-1, and enhancement is 3-to-1. And those ratios, we establish those through public rulemaking and taking lots of public testimony about what works and what doesn't work on the ground, plus it's based on our own experience as to what actually works.
So where do the banks come in that equation? Which category do they fall into?
If you buy a credit from the bank, you buy a credit on whatever the ratios are. And a bank, as it is established in its mitigation banking instrument, will tell us, and we will all agree, bank sponsor, core, DSL, you have so many credits that could be used for enhancement, so many credits could be used for restoration, so many credits could be used for creation. And the banks are set up to be able to sell those credits based on the schedule that we've all agreed to.
If someone wants to get their land into the bank, what about the zoning of the lands presently under? I mean, exclusive farm use, can they place some of their farm into that if they want to flood the area and keep it flooded? I mean, how does this actually work? And somebody makes a commitment to put their land in the bank, and then they have to hope somebody pays them for doing that somewhere down the line. Is that the way you're looking at this?
It becomes a permanent deed restriction.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
most of the wetland mitigation banks are on farmland, and that is a permitted use on farmland. And so in the case of one farmer, Mark Knopp, and I think a few of you have met with him, he looks at the wetland mitigation bank he has on his property as diversification for his farming operation. So he has his wetland mitigation bank, and then he has his grass seed farming elsewhere on that, and he used the lowest quality farmland that he has for the wetland mitigation bank. And that's proved to be a really good business deal for him and provided some continuity for his business.
Madam Chair?
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that gentleman was with my office with John Lilly and you. I think we were there too. I can't remember who I met with anymore. But he took the lowest quality farmland, but obviously the highest quality of potential restored wetland. Needs wet, marginal growing property in the first place. Am I correct in that? And he spoke highly of how it was helping his family's bottom line. So,
how many? Thank you, Madam Chair. How many credits were sold last year in the mitigation banking system?
Let's see. I have the number of credits available. There were 54 available in 2004. I'll have to get you the number that are actually sold, because I don't have that readily available.
17, 18, 6, double.
And yeah, I think that if we don't get moving ahead here, we're going to be here past signing
dogs. Madam Chair, just in the interest of disclosure, let me put on the public record that I have talked to DSL about doing this on my own farm and will likely proceed here this year.
Madam Chair, Janet Moreland is here. If you'd like to ask her some of the specific questions regarding the wetland numbers, because I think she's a little more knowledgeable about that than I am. Janet, or
hi, for the record, I'm Janet Mullen, the Wetlands Program Manager at DSL.
Thank you. We were going through the answers to the questions that were raised during the Phase 1 portion of the hearings on this budget that relate to wetlands in Oregon. And as we were going through this, questions arose about the historical estimates of wetlands and how you could take a map that was drawn in the 1880s or in the 1870s and decide how much wetland there was back then.
Madam Chair, is this for the estuarine wetland figures?
Well, that,
we
and also for the historical acreage wetlands in Oregon, the question that is directly above that, the tidal wetlands question.
Right. Let me start with the estuarine wetlands, if I may. That was done from the State of the Environment report that the when Governor Kitzhaber pulled together a group of scientists under President Risser of Oregon State University, and they went into the records and did a study. And I brought a few copies of that because I'm not sure actually what was attached to the information that you have. And they used the DSL information on filled lands. So it was maps of all the estuarine lands that we knew that had been filled from historic times as the basis for what had previously been estuarine wetlands, and then looked at current maps of how many estuarine wetlands there are.
So does this number represent the mitigation that's taken place since the mitigation regulations have been in place?
Madam Chair, which number? I'm sorry.
Well, for instance, the one around the tidal wetlands, I guess that one wouldn't be a good example because it only goes up to 1970, but bump up to the wetlands in Oregon above that, and there's a statement there, we estimate a wetland loss of 57%, and then there's some information about between 1982 and 1994, there was a loss of 273,000 acres. And the question that was raised was, is that a loss that also reflects the wetlands that were created because of the wetland mitigation regulations? Or are there two separate numbers? Is there another number for wetlands that were created to mitigate than for wetlands that were lost?
Right, Madam Chair, I think I understand the question. There's two different sources of information in those figures, and the wetland loss figures of 468 acres per year is a net loss figure, and it's done from a sample-based study in the Willamette Valley. So they used aerial photos of sample points and then mapped all of the wetland changes in those sample points. So it would have included any mitigation banks, any restoration, any even sort of accidental restoration that occurred. It wasn't looking at permits, but just what were the changes between those two time periods.
So if you were, would it be a fair statement to say then that this is just to make sure that I'm understanding what you're telling me. The wetland loss then reflects the land that was made that was given some other use besides wetlands, but it doesn't reflect the wetlands that were created to mitigate.
Actually, Madam Chair, it does reflect wetlands that were created to mitigate, and that's in the 546 acres per year figure. Because that was done, that data is from 1982. They looked at aerial photos in 1982, and then they looked at the same areas in 1994. So any changes, whether gain or loss, would be reflected in that data. But I think one thing that might make this confusing is the earlier figure
the 57% loss historically, that's based on a different data set. That's looking way back at what do we think the wetlands were in the Willamette Valley before white settlement, and what do we have now in 1994. So that's why there's a difference in that information.
Senator Bates.
Chair, going back to that same sentence, between 1982 and 1994, at 546 acres per year over a 12-year period of time, a net loss would have been about 6,000 acres, it looks like to me.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think I need to look at the math there because the 546 per year is correct. I'm not sure about
272 indicates you had a whole lot of land that was being changed back and forth. That seems a little unlikely to me. You had 272,000 acres, some of which was dried up and others which was flooded, ending up with a net change of 6,000 acres over that period of time. I think that's what's confusing us here. So I think the 272,952 seems a bit high to me.
Right. And the 546 would be an average annual. We don't really know what happened any given year. We only know what happened between 1982 and 1994. But I'll recheck that total figure for you.
Madam Chair, what would be more meaning for me, at least, to find out what percentage of the wetlands in the Willamette Valley that 6,000-acre loss between 82 and 94 represents? Is that a significant part of our wetlands or not? Is it 1%? Is it 20%? Is it 2%? That would be meaningful to me. This is not really meaningful to me.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we don't have a real accurate estimate of how much wetland we have in the Willamette Valley other than the 1994 figure. So I can't tell you historically very accurately, but I can tell you for that period of time. And I could bring that information back to you.
I think that also we're looking for a ballpark number here, not to have it down to 6 or 8 decimal points, but there has to be some way that we can make this relevant, and that is a problem with this information, that it's just little chunks of information that don't really give us a picture, an overall picture of what's going on.
Right. And Madam Chair, I don't have on the tip of my tongue the acreage, but I do know that loss represented about 2.8% of the 1982 base of wetlands, so it was about that 3% range of loss between that period of time.
Thank you very much. We just heard that the definition of a wetland in the state of Oregon is the same as our Corps of Engineers, and it's 3 criteria. Now we're saying that we can tell by an aerial photograph in 1982 if something was a wetland, and then if it had changed from a wetland to something else several years later from another aerial photograph. Was that definition in place, the 3 criteria in 1982? Did you do an inventory of the lands that you took a picture of? And then did you determine it that on the ground that those are wetlands? And if we're not using that criteria, what are we using? How are we coming to this conclusion?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler. They did not use those 3 criteria for this particular study because it would require access to every property and field testing in order to do so. So this would be a conservative estimate of the wetlands.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's forge ahead here, committee members. We are more than half an hour into this, and we're just being page 2. Okay, we had some questions pertaining to the performance measures.
I also want to mention that there was a question asked about the number of wetland credits sold. It was 18 wetland mitigation credits sold in 2004, fiscal year 2004. Okay, so you want me to come in and go on. There were, you had questions regarding the percent of cities with approved and adopted local wetland inventories. Maybe I'll have Janet come back up here. Oh, sorry about that. A second. She's been the one that's also has worked on local wetland inventories, about what the value is of local wetland inventories and that performance measure. So maybe I can have her talk about local wetland inventories and why they're useful.
Madam Chair, Janet Moreland again. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question, but because I was talking with staff.
You're asking us about performance measure 18, the percent of cities with approved and adopted.
Is the question basically about the importance or the reason for doing wetlands inventories?
I was not in this part of the hearing, so I don't know what the discussion was in the committee. Do you remember?
Madam Chair, I do not recall. I don't know if it was Representative Krupp who had this particular question. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, we were bogged down somewhere like we are today just asking questions. And I don't know if it was to any particular point. And I'm quite sure if we go back a year from now, we won't even remember this discussion.
So we could just move on. I mean, okay. Let me read this, and if you have any questions, we can do that. We also answered questions that you had regarding customer service survey questions and wetland removal fill permit compliance. So I'd be happy to answer any specific questions that you might have. In the interest of time, or if you'd like to read this and then come back and ask us any more questions tomorrow.
Okay. And then you've also attached some other information for us here. Oh, how you can apply for a permit. This must be for Representative Crook.
There was a question where they asked about the committee wanted to see an application and the information we provide with an application.
Okay, so this is
a visual joint permit form as well as general authorization. And then we also included in here, in your packet, the report for the removal fill program from 1999 to 2002.
Okay. Let's then move ahead, and probably the next thing would be to let Lisa go ahead and do the analysis on behalf of DAS.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services.
You need me to say that again.
You need that again, Joan.
Okay. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll be working from this document here. This is a very brief summary overview of the governor's recommended budget, and the agency will be getting into greater detail in its presentation that directly follows this one. So if you turn to page 2, there is a chart that we have shown for the Natural Resources Program area, and it shows the all funds budget and the proportion that each agency in Natural Resources takes of that all funds, and then general fund and lottery funds. DSL, excuse me, state lands, is about 4% of the total funds, and it's less than 1% of the general fund. And that general fund is for the Economic Revitalization Team and the Natural Heritage Advisory Commission or Council Committee. Page 3 is just briefly takes a look at the governor's budget principles that this agency fell into. And moving on to the next few pages, there are 4 views of the governor's recommended budget from different perspectives. So on page 4, there is a view of the governor's recommended budget by fund type. The largest is other funds non-limited. This is the common school fund distribution. It is followed by other funds and then by federal funds. The other funds come from interest earnings as well as timber revenue, lease rentals and royalties, and then also land sales, permit fees, unclaimed property donations and publications. The federal fund comes from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for the wetlands program, and then also from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for the South SLU National Estuarine Research Reserve, and also from the Department of Commerce for that. Moving on to page 5. This is a view showing the different programs, and as you can see, the Common School Fund is by far the largest, and this includes such things as land management, rangeland management, waterway leasing, estate administration, trust property, forfeitures, financial and human, financial business administration, that sort of thing, director's office, state land board. So this is where the bulk of the activity occurs. Moving on to page 6.
this view takes a look from the perspective of the major expenditure categories. As you can see, the special payments is the largest. That is the common school fund distribution. But that does make this agency somewhat unique among natural resource agencies. Moving on to page 7, there is a table showing the historical expenditures and then also the governor's proposal. The major changes, you see that there's an increase for general fund. That was the addition of the economic revitalization team money. Also, there are differences on other funds, non-limited, and that reflects the change in the market from the good times of the 1990s through the bad times of the 2000s. There was a common school fund distribution boost in the third special session of the 2001-03 biennium. That was about $17.7 million. And then because the market has rebounded somewhat, there is more money available as of the governor's recommended budget last fall to provide to schools in the distribution. The good news is that there's even more, and I'll be talking about that in a second, and I think the agency will be covering that even further in their presentation. So turning to page 8, common school, major policy issues include protecting the assets of the common school fund and increasing revenues to it. There is also an issue with the removal fill program, and there's a fee proposal that we will be talking about in a moment. The agency is proposing a reorganization, moving its trust property section to the Treasury Department. That's mutually beneficial, and there is a bill in the legislative process to do that.
Representative Schaffler has a question.
Isn't the right time or not, but on the common school fund, the part where you, if you have money that you can't find the person it belongs to, how much is in there and how much do we, how long does it stay there? And then do we get, just take the interest from that and give it to schools?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, in the Common School Fund, the Common School Fund.
Dr. Hannes, if I could just interrupt. In your presentation, your detail, are you going to be addressing the Common School Trust Fund in that presentation?
Yes.
Could we defer the discussion until that time?
The reorganization also includes taking what remains after the trust property section is moved over to Treasury and creating land management program, the Wetlands and Wetlands Conservancy Program, and then finance and administration. Wetland and waterway conservation. Page 9, the remaining major policy issues include the common school fund distribution. It was changed in February 2005, so it is now a rolling average, and that increases the distributions expected above what we budgeted and governors recommended. It actually increases to about $89.9 million, and that's about a $54.6 million increase from where we were at last fall. And then also the regulatory streamlining effort continues with a statewide programmatic general permit. Page 10, the South Slough National Estuary Reserve, Research Reserve management has been an issue in the past. There are some resources added, which I'll talk about in a second, for improved management there. And then the economic revitalization team as well is continued and continues to be of interest to the governor. So investments include, on page 11, generating more income or revenue, to the Common School Fund by continuing the rangeland management efforts that were begun in 2003-05, waterway leasing efforts, Eastern Oregon property management, and unclaimed property staffing. There's also staff provided to intensify land management and implement the asset management plan, and then also to centralize billing and other financial staffing support. On page 12, there are investments for protecting assets, including maintaining and improving rangelands, surveying rangeland conditions, monitoring lease compliance, controlling noxious weeds, suppressing fire, managing forest land, maintaining the headquarters building here in Salem,
cleaning up the Portland Harbor and increasing Salem headquarters building security. And then again, there's continued staffing for the economic revitalization team. On page 13, continuing investments, there is a removal fill program improvement, reducing program reliance on the Common School Fund, which has been taking a portion of the Common School Fund to cover expenditures through a permit fee increase. There is an increase in expenditure limitation for the wetland revolving fund. And there is also continued staffing at the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. And then in terms of reductions on page 14, this agency's reductions were really confined to the statewide savings from the Smart Buy program. On page 15, fee and revenue issues, again, there is this bill, the House bill, to increase removal fill permit fees. This essentially revises the fee schedule for two existing permits and then adds two new fees, and that would be for the wetland delineation and general authorization permits. I don't have a bill number for you because I gather that it's changing. On page 16, we have a number of technical adjustments that we would recommend. First, of course, is the Common School Fund distribution adjustment of $54.6 million. Then in package 108, when we were doing the manual calculations for an adjustment to a position in this program package, we used the accountant 2 position, which it really should have been an accounting tech 2, much lower classification. When we actually went to what was supposed to be in the accounting 2, the numbers that came out of the system were very different from the original calculation. So we would recommend that that adjustment be made and that that lower level position be the one that's actually in the system. And that also a position that was approved at the November Emergency Board for a federal grant that is going to cross biennia between 2003-05 and 05-07 be included as well. And that did not get included because of the timing of the Emergency Board in November. So that sums everything up. As I said, the agency will be going into greater detail, but if you have any questions after overview, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions or comments? Representative Creighton.
Just real quickly, on page 13, you're talking about the added staff for South Slough. Will that come up a little later on in one of the package deals, that position? And we'll get to it then.
I would assume there would be a part of your presentation that details the South Slough Reserve. Further questions or comments? Thank you very much, Ms. Pearson. We appreciate that. And with that, then, we'll turn it back to Director Hannes to go through the budget details.
Madam Chair, can she also please keep us informed what page we're in which book?
Okay. What I'm going to be going through now is phase two part of the presentation. You have, I think, a handout that is the presentation I'm doing as a PowerPoint. We've made just some slight changes, but mostly
you're supposed to have a PowerPoint presentation.
Should have been one that was.
Do we have that?
I think from originally
it was distributed to you during phase one. I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yes.
So that was lucky.
Make a long stance all in one book. One to the end, page one to the end, should be a law about it.
Do you have your copy?
I don't know. I'm just over here whining. I think I do, Madam Chair. Yes, ma'am. I have a PowerPoint.
No, it would be on page, beginning on page 20.
Sure.
Page 20 of the PowerPoint presentation that I had given you during phase one.
I don't know where it is.
is.
We should probably put a rule in place that you shouldn't give praise to presentation materials to legislators during phase.
Yeah, I have no idea what book or where it was put. See, there's the thing. If we get a presentation in phase one and it isn't put in everybody's book at the same place, then you don't know where it is. No idea if I stuck it in the back.
Madam Chair, we'll make that recommendation to the co-chairs.
So Representative Krieger doesn't have one?
I'll look at it.
I'm used to sharing my stuff.
I think our esteemed LFO staffer has gone to bail you out.
Well, it's probably here somewhere amongst these 500 pages.
Okay.
That is one of the best things we could do. Every agency. That's a good suggestion. Every agency, same format, all consecutively numbered pages. No matter what, you can find it, because it doesn't matter where it is, because everything's consecutive. And that's not your fault. That's
no,
just, we need,
not
to,
at all.
We need to get it lined out.
Madam Chair, do you want me to start, or do you want me to wait for a minute or
give
two?
Me a couple, give a couple of minutes for Ms. McGlashan
okay.
to do that copy
then
work,
I'll
because
just
she's also that. Taking notes as this is going along.
Hi, Madam Chair, local constituents, kids.
Glad you could join us.
You made a motion, Senator, on your behalf that everything be numbered consecutively.
Thank you. So
all
that'll be a lot.
We've also requested that phase two materials not be given to legislators before phase two because we'll lose them.
We'll lose them automatically. Right. 2 minutes before we walk in the room is about right. Huh?
And I'm sorry, I should have brought extra copies, but I just...
I think amazing thing, Madam
so
Chair,
you're
is if
you
look at the
floor.
You're
supposed to be now locating your PowerPoint presentation from phase one.
It's in
the first book.
Yeah,
first
this is the first book.
Probably.
Which I happen to have there, amazingly.
But we have in our office somewhere between 30 and 40 of these types of books,
mm-hmm.
and there's no place for them. You stack them and you figure out who they are.
Well, there's like 14 budgets, and there's two books each, at least.
There's 28.
Books.
That's not counting the other stuff they give you or other committees.
Other things, yeah.
See, what you're looking for is something that looks like this.
It's in this big book?
No, it should be in the
it
first
was in
book.
In your
book
phase one.
It was given to you during phase one.
This one's is this phase one?
Yeah.
I'm sneaking up.
wouldn't be that was it says phase one PowerPoint phase.
That's
one.
It.
Oh my God!
Page 20.
Yeah, turn to page 20. No. Oh wait a minute. Yeah.
I recognize the picture.
Page 20.
You've been here before.
You're in good shape.
That's questionable, but that's all right. Thank you.
While we're waiting, can we get a report on Senator Shields? Is he doing okay?
He's
okay.
He's on session. Anyway.
He's doing session, then goes home rest afterwards. He had a viral infection around his heart. Probably another 3 or 4 weeks before he's up to full speed. He's doing better.
I think it's a direct result of global warming. That's what I told him.
Global what?
Global warming.
Global warming.
You gotta be careful.
That was cool.
I just believe that. Be careful.
Start saying it, it'll become the truth.
Environmentalist there.
For your redemption, Senator Shield, or Senator Nelson, you'll be glad to know that. And did you make a copy for Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, I did not.
Feel free to
Senator Nelson will share with Senator Bates.
Yeah, we can do that. We're bipartisan. We can share.
Sharing is good. Okay, please
proceed. Thank you. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, Director, Department of State Lands, and I'm starting on the Phase 2 presentation. As requested, we're going to be covering these different points that are shown in this slide for phase two, looking at budget drivers and changes over the last 10 years and cost containment for contracts, major budget issues, policy packages, and balance and legislation. Our mission, I would like to just go back a second to what we covered in phase one. Our mission is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians in their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates in the Common School Fund. We're the administrative arm of the State Land Board. We manage Common School Fund assets. We protect and conserve state waterways and wetlands. We also manage the South Slough Estuarine Reserve and the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. Our major agency initiatives include boosting the Common School Fund to increase money to schools. We're going to do that through aggressive land management, looking at land sales of parcels that are difficult or uneconomical to manage. We're pursuing in-lieu federal lands and also with unclaimed property to boost that, as well as the proposed transfer to the Treasurer's Office. I'd just like to note that in so doing, I'll give you a couple examples of what we've done recently. On March 30th, we sold 7 parcels through open competitive bidding. These were isolated tracts. We raised $443,000. That was 10% above the appraised value. Likewise, we had an unclaimed property auction, which had auctioned off coins and jewelry, even baseballs that were signed by some of the greats. And that raised over $100,000. What was I thought was fun about that auction with unclaimed property is that we held the auction at Parrish Middle School. So we paid the rent for the auction to Parrish Middle School, and they benefited from that. And the Parents Club sold the refreshments, so they raised $800 for their 8th grade graduation students.
So this $443,000 from the land sales and the $100,000 from the unclaimed property, is that net or is that gross?
That's net. That goes into the Common School Fund.
Okay.
And we're also in the process of pursuing 3,200 acres of in-lieu lands. That's a debt that the federal government has owed to us. We're looking at protecting Common School Fund assets. This includes updating our asset management plan. Whereas in that update of the asset management plan, we are establishing values for each of our parcels and also determining what benchmarks we should have for return on our investments. The Elliott State Forest Habitat Conservation Plan and the Forest Management Plan are under development by the Department of Forestry, and you've already had a presentation on the cost-benefit study. And the factors of that cost-benefit study will be useful as we look at the Forest Management Plan. Hazardous waste cleanup is another area that we're going to be heavily involved in, particularly in the Portland Harbor. Since we own the bed and the banks of waterways, that means we're the landowner in the Portland Harbor cleanup area. We've been working, again, very closely with DOJ and DEQ on that, and you'll hear more about that in one of the program option packages. Noxious weed control is one that you'll hear about in Program Option Package 102 because that is a major issue in eastern Oregon, particularly for weeds like pepperweed and medusa head. Fire protection is another area. With talk of the drought, I think we're concerned about fires in our rangelands, but we've never really had money appropriated specifically for fire protection. And then building maintenance, you'll hear more about that. Our building is 15 years old, and we need maintenance. And the current value of that building is $11.4 million. We've also focused on improving customer service over the last couple years. We've done extensive outreach and training. For example, in the removal fill program, we've held nearly 50 seminars throughout the state with about 1,400 attendees. For the unclaimed property, we've had 21 seminars. In fact, we're holding a seminar over these last couple days in Southern Oregon as I speak. We've been a member of the economic revitalization team in certifying industrial lands. I mentioned reorganizing the agency that we're planning for July 1st, and that will allow us, I think, to focus more clearly on the goals that we have under our strategic plan and trying to meet what we're trying to do with boosting revenues to the Common School Fund and streamlining the removal fill program. We've used technology so that people can get online and see exactly where they are with their permits, as well as to be able to do placer mining permits online so it speeds it along and you know what is going on with your permit. And then we've done extensive customer service surveys. Not only do you get a survey like this in with every application that you submit in for a removal fill application, you can go online and do that. And then in order to know that we're really getting the best numbers on customer service that's really out there, we do a random survey, a telephone survey in the summertime to find out how what people are thinking about our service. We've done surveys, too, following each unclaimed property audit that we've done. This next slide shows the Common School Fund. You've seen this before in phase one. It shows the constitutional revenue that flows in the upper left-hand corner. That includes, for example, timber harvesting and grazing revenue. Statutory revenue on the upper right is waterway leasing. This shows also where our expenses are taken off of from statutory expenses as well as from the Common School Fund for constitutional expenses. The unclaimed property receipts are held in trust, and then it's the earnings that come off of there, the interest and the dividends that are distributed to schools on a semi-annual basis.
Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. How much is in there? How much cash do we have that we're earning that interest off of?
As of the end of February, I believe we had $918 million in the Common School Fund. About 30% of that is bonds, 70% of that is stocks.
What do other states do? Are we doing exactly like other states, or do states dip into that and lower that? Does it fluctuate historically? Is that a pretty relatively static number? Is it slowly going up?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, the school trust lands started essentially with Ohio.
Lands. I'm talking about that $918 million.
The land grants started with Ohio, and so each state as they came into the union had different specifications in their constitution and their admissions act about what governs their particular common school fund. So it does vary significantly by state in terms of how they manage their common school fund.
What's to prevent us in times of downward trends in revenue from dipping into that money to bail ourselves out?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, in fact, the legislature did use $17 million of money that was in the Common School Fund that was accumulation of 50 years of receipts from the statutory revenue. There was advice from the Attorney General that was provided over the last 2 to 4 years that spoke specifically about the restrictions connected with using other, you know, the rest of the principal in the Common School Fund.
Those restrictions, minimum quit. Is it a constitutional restriction, a statutory restriction? Exactly, specifically what? And if you want to just get me that information, yeah. I can read it myself.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffler, we can get you a copy of that advice. That restriction really has the basis in our Admissions Act, the Constitution, as well as trust law.
Is it not true that the restriction is related to the revenue source?
Chair Morton, that is correct. If it's constitutionally based revenue source, and by that we mean revenue from that original land grant. So the Elliott State Forest is probably a prime example of a constitutional revenue source with the timber harvest. And the waterway revenues is a good example of statutory revenue that's been designated there by the legislature.
And the unclaimed property is another piece. I mean, my recollection of the discussions around what was eligible to be included in the category for that accelerated take out of the fund had to do with things that were statutory rather than constitutionally flowing into the fund.
That is correct. The unclaimed property is kind of a separate type of revenue source, and it is really held in trust in perpetuity. So the state never takes title to that unclaimed property, but the common school fund does get the benefit of the investment earnings on that until the rightful owners are found. And that is that unclaimed property part, it amounts to about $190 million now.
Is there not also a point in time where the unclaimed property does a sheet or become a part of the principal of the common school fund?
Chair Morton, essentially no. There was a point in time, a short point in time, where some of it did escheat, but the overwhelming bulk of the unclaimed property in the common school fund does not escheat. And that's different than estates, where when we have somebody that dies without an heir and without a will, and that goes into the common school fund after 10 years, if we don't find an heir, then that is cheats to the state.
How many levels there are to this discussion.
Thank you for being so patient.
Please proceed.
We talk about some of the budget drivers and environmental factors. In terms of the revenue to the common school fund, it's very much affected by the economy. For example, the common school fund stands at $918 million. When the stock market took a dive after 9/11, so did the common school fund. How interest rates are will affect what our returns are as well. Lease rental rates depend on what the market conditions are for leases. And then having adequate staff available to market agency resources also affects what we can do on our lands. In terms of expenses to the Common School Fund, legal and environmental factors are often very driving forces. Spotted owls and marble murrelets on the Elliott State Forest affect how much we can harvest there. Sage grouse can affect what it means for rangeland protection. Fire, the presence of cultural resources, if we're selling property or wanting to lease it, if there are cultural resources there, we need to factor that in. Noxious weeds is another one. If we have noxious weeds taking over parcels, that will limit or sometimes even eliminate being able to use that parcel for any productive means. And environmental cleanup is going to be a very complex and expensive undertaking, particularly for hazardous waste cleanup in the Portland Harbor in the years ahead.
Well, and I would also submit that another addition to the list of expenses would also be the cost of running the agency.
Very much so, yes. I agree, because that is a factor in profitability in terms of the Common School Fund goes. We're looking at trying to reduce uncertainty for land management decisions. That's why we're working on the asset management plan and use that to guide our real estate management. And then administrative rules also provide guidance in terms of how we manage for those lands or how, for example, we should undertake a sale. Protecting assets is another area that affects the agency and the budget. We have plans to look at help protect for long-term productivity. For example, when we do our rangeland management plans, that helps us determine what is the carrying capacity of those lands and what is the revenue potential of the resources. Lack of staff over the years has also prevented us from being able to do some more aggressive land management that we would like to do in the future. And an example of that is when we're trying to look at getting these 3,200 acres of land, most of those parcels of land, if not all of them, we're trying to have ones that could be commercially developed. And so if we do that, then we've got to be able to have the means to be able to work on those plans and get those properties ready for development. Likewise, we have instances of trespass on state lands, and we have to deal with those instances of trespass. And then lastly, I did talk about the return on investment. Since we are heavily invested in the market, we're also subject to the whims of the market as well. Major agency changes. The changes are here that I'm going to be talking about do focus on what we've been trying to do to more aggressively manage common school fund resources and maximize returns. I appreciate that over the last 4 years, the legislature has given us some needed positions for rangeland management. For example, we have one position that deals with rangeland management, and that was given to us for the first time 4 years ago, and that's been instrumental in working with the ranchers and making sure that we're managing those effectively. Also, we've just received in the last session a position for Eastern Oregon property management, and that position has helped us greatly when we've marketed, for example, those seven properties that I talked about earlier, getting those all ready for sale and doing the due diligence on them.
Those leases do you have on leasing rangeland that one person works with?
For the rangeland specialist?
I just wondered how many, we're talking 50, 100, I don't have any idea.
144 leases
on
rangelands. And that's, I think it's also been important, you'll hear from Glenn Stonebrink about that, given that we were in litigation in the mid to late 90s, having that position is very important to have that program continue. We have also have an unclaimed property auditor position that we'd like to continue. In that position, what we find is that for every dollar that we spend on an auditor, we get about $22 in return in unclaimed property. So that's a pretty good rate of return.
Madam Chair. How many positions? That's for every dollar you get $22. Eventually, after you, if you added two, you get 44. Eventually, that would balance out. How long would we go before? What kind of investment would we have to get to really get the maximum optimum? Or is that the optimum right there?
Madam Chair, Representative Shaw, I don't think we're at the optimum by any means. We have three auditors now. They do unclaimed property, but they also audit for state land management to make sure leases are in compliance and that we're getting, say, the proper royalty that we need from activities taking place on state lands. I'm not sure. I don't know. Pamela, do you have any? Let me bring Pamela up here.
For the record, my name is Pamela Constantopoulos. I am the fiscal manager for the Department of State Lands, and I supervise the auditors. We have three auditor positions. At present, we have recently sort of refigured things to where two of them are devoted solely to unclaimed property. The third one is now doing proprietary audits on our various leases and contractual agreements out there. The two unclaimed property auditors, well, we say that for each dollar that we spend, it brings in $22. That would be on an annual basis, essentially. The big thing to remember on these auditors is that they're going out and they're getting these companies into compliance. Most of these companies have never filed unclaimed property reports in the past. So there is an ongoing return in addition to the $22 that occurs immediately, in essence. That results from these auditors that are out there doing the work. We have a significant problem out there in getting companies into compliance, and we're working very diligently to get the word out and to have outreach and to get people out to the companies to let them know. Follow up.
So if we invested $4, would we get 88 or would we get 40? I mean, that's what I'm looking for right there. I mean, if we're going to get a whole bunch of money back, you see where I'm going, Madam Chair?
But you're looking for where the line is that the returns start diminishing?
Yes. And I mean, if we can be guaranteed we're going to get $40 for $4, it'd be worth bumping it up to $4 because we'd get all that cash back.
There are several hundred thousand businesses out there which are not reporting at this point in time. We don't know if they need to report or not because we haven't heard from them and we have been unable to contact them because we don't have enough staff. So immediately I could say that we could use, you know, quite a number of more auditors to get the word out and to get out to all these businesses. At the present rate, you know, if they do one audit a week, we're only reaching about 150 businesses in a year. So, and, you know, again, one of them may come out and they'll have an audit that comes back at $20,000 in return to the Common School Fund, but that company from that point forward is now submitting reports, and it may be an additional $20,000 every year thereafter that they're contributing.
But if I might, just for my own personal clarification, the money that comes in through the work of these auditors, the $22 that's returned for every $1 that is invested, it is the interest from that that actually accrues to the Common School Trust Fund. Is that correct?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
So when you, is the 1 to 22 that based on the unclaimed, the total value of the unclaimed property, or is it based on what's returned to the Common School Trust Fund as interest?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I believe that that is the total amount of money which goes into the corpus of the fund, which then gains interest. It is not the interest.
So is there any way to do a number that would gauge what is actually returned in interest to the Common School Trust Fund against the cost of the auditors?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'd be glad to work up some numbers for you.
That would be great. I think that would be interesting information for us. Please proceed.
Okay. We're also working to support economic development, and we're doing this through positions that we have for the ODOT bridge and road construction projects. These two positions are in the removal fill program, and they're there to try to help expedite the permits process to make sure that bridge construction and road projects can proceed. We also have a position for the economic revitalization team, and that position has been vital for doing the certification of industrial lands, for example, the Lebanon Sutherland site, and expediting certification and review in eastern Oregon as well. I've mentioned about customer service outreach. The position that we have we have a position in trust property for claims processing and educational outreach to let people know that they actually have money in the Common School Fund as part of unclaimed property. Whenever we've had a major show done on a TV, there's been times where it's actually brought down the entire state website because we've had so many inquiries coming in. I think the chances of getting unclaimed property are probably higher than if you get buy a lottery ticket. So people are interested to see whether or not they've got unclaimed property that either they or their family members have. And that's been part of the outreach in addition to educating businesses about their need to comply with the unclaimed property statutes. We also provide public services and visitor services at South SLU. We've been involved with removal fill program streamlining. In fact, I was pleased that Colonel Hobernick came before the land board yesterday and said that he felt that he would be able to sign the SPGP probably by summertime. Crossing my fingers on that. He said he wants to do it before he retires, which would be at the end of June. So we're hoping and looking forward to being able to implement that in the fall. We've also worked with people on land management. For example, when there have been questions about dock registrations, we've held seminars in the local communities to work with individuals and help them through the applications. And I mentioned the surveys that we're doing. In terms of cost containment and program improvements, we have proposed to reorganize the agency effective July 1st. Again, that will allow us to be able to focus more clearly on the goals that we want to achieve for land management and the removal fill program. We've also used students and volunteers, trainees, interns extensively in the agency, not only for South SLU, where we have a very active friends group there, but also other friends groups like the Friends of Dibley Point. We've had volunteers come in within the state DSL here in Salem that have contributed their time. In terms of land management, selling isolated tracts of land, I think, is helping to reduce our costs because then we can focus on the more higher returning lands, and pursuing that land debt will also improve the program, and I think dramatically so. In fact, one of the things that I was really encouraged were right now with our asset management plan getting valuations for each of our parcels, and we learned that the Stevens Road track, which is was an in-lieu land that we had acquired a number of years ago. About 10 years ago, it was valued at about, I think, about $3 million. Today, it's upwards of $15 to $18 million, and I think that bodes well for the selection of lands that we're trying to go after for the in-lieu lands and the value that that might be with those lands. We're always having to deal with trespass issues. For example, if we have... we collect leases off of communication sites. We'll go back and look at those communication sites, and we'll find that there are new ones that have sprouted up that we hadn't known about. And then we'll have to pursue those and get those under lease as well. And then trying to improve the condition of the lands. That's been a major effort with our rangeland improvement and working with the ranchers, where we also dedicate 12% of the revenues coming in from rangeland for rangeland improvement projects.
Thank you. How many these communication towers, you're talking about cell sites, and how many of those are trespassed by, you know, our phone company? Who's doing this?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffer, I can have Steve Purchase come up and talk about the number of sites that we have, but it may be like a cell phone company that subleases the land, and if they sublease it, then they're supposed to come through us so that we get the revenue. They don't, and that goes into the common school fund. We'll have people just putting up towers for a variety of reasons. It's across the board.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffer, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Department of State Lands. Ann answered the question pretty well. We have 24 communication site leases currently. It is not unusual for us to make an inspection on communication sites and find someone has added an additional dish or tower or even a building and subleased our land without paying us the appropriate fees.
And Chair, and you go back in time and charge them for when they hooked it up? Is there a way to measure that and then get the money paid back?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffer, we try to do that as best as we can in the settlement of that. Sometimes the information is not as forthcoming as one would hope, and we try to get that from them to be able to resolve what the past due rents are.
If things aren't forthcoming and clear, then do we apply a hefty fine?
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffer, currently under the state leasing laws, there is not a civil penalty authority associated with that. Only on the waterways where we have civil penalty authority. So we would have to go to litigation to collect that money.
Thank you.
Also on land management, about a year ago there was an audit that was released by the Secretary of State on the rangeland grazing fee. We formed a grazing fee advisory committee. That committee has been working diligently over the last about 5 or 6 months. And has broad representation, and we're hoping that we'll have a recommendation from that committee in early summer. Well, I've also mentioned about sharing improvement costs with rangeland lessees, conducting rangeland inventories. We have about 640,000 acres of rangeland, and we try to do anywhere between 30 to 50,000 acres of our rangeland assessment each year. It's hard to manage land if you don't know what's out there on your land, and by doing that rangeland inventory, it gives us the information that we have to know what the condition is in terms of weeds, what we need to do for stocking requirements. And you'll see in a little bit that one of our, we do have a request to have some seasonal positions so that we can have those and do that each summer. We had a fire. We have a fire agreement with the BLM because the BLM lands are intermixed with our lands, and that has actually been very cost-effective for us. Department of Forestry does not protect in many of these rangelands that we have. They're unprotected areas, so it was the first time we were able to bring Common School Fund lands under some type of protection program. The removal fill program. You know, we talk about streamlining with this SPGP, but we're looking at some other ways that we can also pursue streamlining. For example, right now we have a process going on where DEQ and DSL have jointly hired a quality improvement specialist, and we've been going through what we call the removal fill improvement process, working with a number of agencies, and I'm really excited about the kind of suggestions they're going to come up with in that process. The and we're looking for other ways to simplify routine and expedite permits that we have. And that includes doing more general authorizations and looking for ways that it can make it easier for individuals. The we've provided online permit status. I've mentioned that before. And the industrial certification. Trust property, I mentioned the number of seminars that we have throughout the state, and that we've also formed a trust property advisory committee with members of businesses on there, banks, for example, to give us advice about how best to manage that program. In finance and administration, one of the things we're doing is coordinating our agency databases, getting our land management database to talk with our finance database, so that we know and can track what's going on in terms of our revenues. And then as a result of direction from this committee last session, we are in the process of revising our agency budget chart of accounts so that we can track the revenue streams with the expenditure streams and match them up. For South SLU, we have... We've expanded visitor hours, center hours, to Saturdays without having to affect the overall hours that staff have, and they've done that by juggling their hours and having some of them work on weekends. We've improved the facilities and infrastructure there and continue with habitat restoration activities that have been models for watershed councils to use and to be involved with. And we continued some research that's important for the coastal communities. Some of this research includes studying oysters and eelgrass and in controlling invasive species.
Can you talk to us about the funding sources for the reserve?
Yes. Over half of the money for the reserve comes from federal funds and grants from non-federal institutions. For example, we got a grant from the Washington State University, and that's used for research purposes or for restoration purposes or education. But NOAA is probably the bulk of the funding that the agency gets. And I can, let me see, I think I've got the number. They received about $1.3 million in for the 0507 budget. They received about we're looking at $1.3 million in federal funds and about $1.1 million in other funds. And of that $1.1 million in other funds, $847,000 of that is Common School Fund.
And I don't know what you did in phase one of the budget presentation because I wasn't here, but I'm curious with the Senator Bates, we're discussing the South SLU Reserve. We've just begun a discussion on the South SLU Reserve, and I've just asked the director to talk to the committee briefly about the funding sources. And the bulk of the funding sources are grant monies, federal grant monies, and grant monies for various
projects that are related to research. But there's about $877,000 of the budget that comes from the Common School Fund.
So, question arises.
That was my next question.
My question.
Why
all that?
We did not orchestrate this. I just asked the question about half an hour ago, so go ahead.
Sure. I think it was in either 97 or 99 that through budget cutting efforts, 97. Thank you. South SLU was made an asset of the Common School Fund, and thus it was taken off of the general fund, and its funding also comes from the Common School Fund.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
It seems strange to me that an asset costs you money, and that's what it basically does, as far as I can see. You know, the advantage is you take kids in there for educational purposes. I understand that.
It's got a strong educational component to it. So we have a lot of kids come and visit. We provide education materials. We had the Estuary Life program, for example, that was broadcast not only statewide but worldwide. So it does provide a lot of services. And the land there is an asset of the Common School Fund.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Krieger wanted to say something too, but I understand that issue, but my understanding of your mission is to supply funds for the schools, not to be a school yourself. That's just me looking at this thing. I appreciate what you're trying to do. What occurs to me that part of it should be taken over by a different department. For me, it would be Parks and Rec. It would be an appropriate place to have them pick this up. They should be the ones in charge of this. They're the ones who should be putting $800,000. $800,000 should stay in the Common School Fund for education of our children. That's just me speaking. Others may certainly disagree with that and feel it's not an appropriate consideration, but I don't understand how you pick up an asset that costs money out of the Common School Fund when your goal has been to enlarge the Common School Fund as much as you possibly can. You've done a great job of doing that over the years. It just seems a little backward where this particular project is going. Just me again.
Sure. Representative Krieger.
And we've got Senate Bill 857 that just passed out, which would increase the size of the South SLU. I don't know how much the increase is and how much increases are going to be in the cost of managing that additional land and assets. And where would that money come from?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, the bill 857 doesn't automatically increase South SLU. It changes the descriptive boundary where the South SLU could acquire land. So one of the acquisitions that's been in question is a joint project with the Charleston Merchants, and that's in downtown Charleston. And what we've heard from NOAA, in order to acquire that property, it would need to be part of South SLU, and that would all come from federal funds. We also have monies that were bequeathed to the South SLU by Mr. Gustafson, and there's about $2 million of monies that could be used for acquisitions as well. But that boundary is just a descriptive boundary. It isn't one that says all the land within that would be acquired by South SLU.
If they were to spend the $2 million to acquire any of this, then you've got a bigger asset like Senator Bates was talking about, then what's the income source to cover the management of that increased land that if they did spend the $2 million to acquire the land?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, I think it would depend on the kind of land that is acquired. If you'd acquire, for example, tidal flats or area that didn't require a lot of management, then it could be absorbed within existing staff. In the case of the visitor facility, that was all going to be federal funds.
The acquisition was to be
federal
funds.
Yes, the acquisition fund and the construction of it.
And what about the ongoing maintenance and staffing needs and that kind of thing?
We have an agreement with the Charleston Merchants in terms of what the merchants would provide in terms of the overall needs of that facility.
Well, Madam Chair, there's the visitor center as far as, for the South SLU and your headquarters. A separate part of that same thing is the
other component. You know, the Charleston merchants, I wouldn't find would be paying your part of it, of that building and upkeep and maintenance and personnel there.
We would be sharing the costs. So what we'd have to, when we'd be doing that, we'd be looking at either applying for increased federal costs or trying to see where we can absorb that in our budget. And that would be moving the administrative headquarters of South Flu to that building, and the interpretive center would stay where it's at.
I recall in the last session when we worked on the DSL budget, there was some pretty pointed conversation with the South Flu Reserve folks about getting off of the Common School Trust Fund funding stream, and that they got some direction to go out and look for alternate funding sources so that we could begin the process of weaning them off of the Common School Trust funds. What progress has been made there? Where are they at?
Well, in fact, there was, is it Senate Bill 91 that just recently passed the Senate and will be coming to the House now. That bill would be able to authorize the commission to charge fees at South SLU. Now, the commission did look at what fees would be appropriate to charge at South SLU. I think there's areas, for example, rental of rooms would be a very appropriate place to charge fees. But the commission felt, and the advisory committee that reported to the commission felt that admission fees would not be a good thing because that would dampen tourism in the area. So I think there's some areas where we can charge fees appropriately that would help offset the Common School Fund.
Well, I think that in the fiscal situation that the state's in and the extreme need that I think all of us feel to get money into the K-12 system, it's my intention to follow through on what was set in motion in the last session and begin weaning the agency off of this funding stream. So I would hope that they are taking this very seriously and that the activities around looking for other funding streams have gone beyond just the thought about charging admission for certain activities or charging rent for certain activities.
The other area that they've been very aggressive in is looking for other grants. One of the things that I mentioned with the budget of South SLU is that while they get $1.1 million in other funds, about $330,000 of that comes from other types of grant funding for a variety of things happening at South SLU. A lot of that, though, is research, and a lot of that research is very beneficial to the coastal communities.
Okay, but I would just reiterate that the intention here is to wean them off of the Common School Trust Fund monies, and so we will be proceeding in that direction in the budget.
Madam Chair, I'd like to take this back to my caucus, discuss with my co-chair, and might want to move a little more aggressively than you're even speaking to right now, but I'd like to get more input on it, talk to the local representatives and senators in that area. It's got economic impact here, and obviously it's important for developers in the area. Also, there's lots of stuff involved with South SLU, and I don't feel really comfortable being from Medford and really come in here and trying to describe what should happen or shouldn't happen in this area. But I think it's worth a very thorough discussion at this point.
Well, and to that, I would only add, Senator Bates, that this has been an ongoing discussion. This should come as no surprise to the reserve that this is moving forward.
Madam Chair, I would concur with the Senator and think it's an interesting idea worth exploring about having perhaps parks assume the responsibility for the operation of the facility as long as the federal funds can still flow and the research and those types of things can still occur and the educational component is there. I like the idea of also weaning off the South SLU or simply cutting it off altogether and changing its funding source and saving the general fund.
Okay.
Well, and I think, too, that the ability for the board of the South SLU to go before the Parks Commission and plead their case is a path that's very open to them and always has been.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems the Parks is going to have some extra money here, so.
The one agency, when I look at their budget, has never been cut because of 66, and they have a steady increasing flow of cash to water, and they're using it well. They're being careful. They're using it appropriately. It's not in any way criticizing what they're doing, but there are other opportunities here for them, possibly.
I agree with that, but I also think that it's important that we consider the role of the Parks Commission in these decisions.
Absolutely. Lots of stuff involved, and that's why I'm being very cautious in my statements here. Just kind of look into it, see if it's appropriate, not appropriate. There's lots of players involved, and I don't think that a person from Medford should be speaking out too strongly here. Let's take a look at it.
Well, how about someone from the South Coast, Madam Chair?
Not my area anymore since redistricting.
But it used to be, and you're closer than I am.
I agree.
Passing the buck, Representative.
Okay. Any more comments or questions related to the South Sioux Reserve? Let's go ahead then, Director.
In terms of professional services and purchasing contracts, we maintain about 30 different contracts, and we've used this for a number of different purposes, ranging from updating our asset management plan to improving our software in our land management and unclaimed property to doing feasibility studies, as well as building repairs. Major budgetary issues. My goal is to try to double the size of the Common School Fund over the next 10 years and to manage Common School Fund land and assets according to the asset management plan. Also trying to protect Common School Fund assets, as I mentioned before, and streamlining the removal fill process. We're looking at increasing the removal fill permit fee. I think you'll hear more about that. That's House Bill 2130, although that is going to be, I think, moved to another bill, 2265 is likely where that's going to be moved to. And then supporting the governor's initiatives. These outline the essential packages. I'm not going to go through each one of them. Most of them are technical adjustments. In terms of the policy option packages before you, we're looking at generating revenue for the Common School Fund and protecting Common School Fund assets. I think these are common themes that you're hearing, as well as cleaning up the Portland Harbor, supporting statewide bridge repair, increasing building security, improving the removal fill program, increasing the Wetland Revolving Fund, and supporting South SLU research. Turning to Program Option 101, this continues the work of 7 full-time staff for rangeland management, waterway leasing, Eastern Oregon property management, and unclaimed property. There are 7 positions involved here with a fiscal impact of $807,000. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's good work.
Wow.
I caught that one.
Call 911.
Yeah. That group is important because of the work that they've done on boosting revenues coming into the Common School Fund and protecting the Common School Fund. Program Option Package 103 would increase the long-term return to the Common School Fund, and this does add 2 positions to intensify land management. We're going to need these positions to help sell isolated and difficult-to-manage parcels, as well as manage those 3,200 acres of in-lieu lands coming in. This will be important for rebalancing our portfolio.
Representative Krupp has a question.
Thank you. And package number 103, fiscal impact $800,000,
mm-hmm.
2 FTE.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really expensive FTE.
That also includes services and supplies. S&S for contracts, because we're going to need to do a lot of contracting for planning and zoning our property and a variety of things.
So it's just not, that's not all personal services.
Madam Chair, if it would so please, I'd like to have the director or staff provide us with a breakdown of how you intend to spend that $800,000.
We can do that.
If you could do that, please. Thanks.
Yes.
I would also like to have information on what we can expect in terms of a return on the investment.
And one of the things that will be difficult to say is, you know, in the next 2 years of what that return will be, because a lot of the work over the next 2 to 4 years is going to be getting those lands ready for development. So we won't have an immediately, I'll say we won't have an immediate return on some of that. So, now we will have more land sales that will be going on, but those 3,200 acres are going to require a lot of land management.
Well, and I think it would be worthwhile then to have a discussion on return on investment, maybe two bienniums out, one biennium and two bienniums, so we can kind of get a picture at what we're buying.
Madam Chair, have we been provided with, and I don't recall seeing the asset management plan.
We can get you a copy of the current version of the asset management plan. There also was a memo that we sent to Sue McGlashan on March 15th that either Sue could provide you with or we can get you copies of that talk about program option package 101 and 102 and 103 and provides a lot more information on each of those and what it would mean.
Sure.
I guess the reason I want to see the asset management plan is I want to understand where we're headed in terms of selling off properties. How many properties are we going to sell? How big is that universe? Over what length of time? Those types of issues so that we can, I think, make a proper decision on this particular policy package and look at that ROI on that.
And Pamela, do you want to come up and talk about what's in that package? And maybe Steve Purchase might want to add to that in terms of 103.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, once again, for the record, I'm Pamela Constantopoulos, and I'm the fiscal manager for the Department of State Lands. Package 103, if you refer to your budget books, the big one, on page 290, it gives some detail on the program option package. Following those pages on page 292, it gives a specific breakdown. You'll find that the two positions have a cost of $268,000. Then there are service and supplies costs of $32,000, which support the activities of those two positions. The bulk of the package is $500,000, which is in land and improvement capital outlay, which will permit the functioning of these land sale exchanges and cover the costs of the transactions themselves.
Okay. Are you done?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume it's a white, nice way of saying commissions on land sales.
No.
No?
Do you want to talk about the kinds of land activities you're going to do with
that? I just want to get an idea of what you're selling off, what you're buying. Is this public land now becoming private land? Do you expect to sell it primarily to private individuals, companies? Where are the 3,200 acres?
We may do a combination of things with the 3,200 acres. We may retain some of the lands and lease them. If it's commercial property, for example, we may sell some of the lands. What we're going to need to do is to look at what is the best way to manage those lands overall.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Field Operations. In addition, this package would also give us positions to not only assist us in getting some of these scattered, isolated, unleased, unproductive lands sold to the marketplace through an open competitive process, but then we've got to figure out where to reinvest the money that we just made in the sale of the property. And, you know, one of our goals has been to increase the long-term revenue stream to the Common School Fund. And the only way you can get there is you've got to be able to look at other revenue-generating opportunities and do some analysis to figure out if that's an appropriate investment for the Common School Fund. And it takes staff to do that. And it takes some staff expertise that we don't have.
Representative Krupp, did you have a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. On page 290, it talks about a 10-year period as much as 15,000, and I'm looking at the first paragraph under how achieved. And if you go down to the last couple of sentences, over a 10-year period, as much as 15,000 acres of isolated, unblocked rangelands would be sold along with 10,000 acres of scattered timber tracts for a total return of about $30 million. Transaction and staff costs are estimated to be about one-third of the sales revenue over a 10-year period. That's awfully high. Transaction and sales costs, or staff costs, I mean, that's $10 million to get us $30 million. I don't understand that at all. That's way high, in my opinion.
It's nowhere near as good as the 1 for 22 we were talking about earlier. Which, and Madam Chair, it says investigation of trespass in here, too.
Could you talk to us about what the staff and transaction costs actually are and why they represent 33% of the sales revenue?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm not sure I understand exactly what that sentence says to me, but and nor do I think I can explain it to you. But it cost us money to sell a piece of property. We have to go through our due diligence. We have to go through an appraisal. We have to go through cultural resources review. We have to do public meetings. We have to do a number of things to prepare a piece of property for sale. And when you do that, when you go through the process, establish a bid package and a market data, and market that property, that all costs money. And a good rule of thumb is it costs about 5% of the land value to actually prepare a piece of property for sale and get that part of it done. I think what this budget or this budget discussion is trying to talk about is the total cost of the asset management plan staff positions is, I'm going to kind of shoot a little bit off the hip here, is about $800,000 a year based on what we've seen and what we propose to do. But this package also includes some other things on property management besides the staff cost. So I'm not sure that I can explain that.
Perhaps we could have you do a little bit more research into this and delineate some of the costs for us more. I think that one of the issues here is going to be the process that the agency develops around spinning these parcels off and trying to make that be as streamlined and as cost-effective as possible, because obviously this is the same issue that we've discussed many times with this agency, that the cost of the processes are drains on the revenue stream going into the Common School Trust Fund, and we obviously have a great deal of concern about keeping those costs as small as they can be. So any information that you could give us to help us understand how this is going to unfold and why 33% of the sales revenue is going to be needed to pay for the process of selling the property would help us understand whether this is a good idea or not. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest that Doss can give some help there. Usual commercial property sales, you're looking 7-8% to sell a piece of property. As a commissioner, and the real estate agent's expected to do a lot of this work for you. It's your fair market. Their job is to get the highest possible price for your piece of property. They're 7% dependent on that, and they will do most of this for you and should do it for you. That's what happens to the commercial side. There may be special requirements because it's public land. It makes it much more difficult for you. We might want to look at legislation that might relieve you of some of that. We're trying to sell property the best and highest value to support the K-12 school system. I also suggest, I'm not sure it's within your range of what you need to do to tell us how to invest that. The Treasury Department does that. Has done a good job for us. I don't think when you auction off stuff from unclaimed property that you try to direct that in a certain direction. I assume you turn it over to the Treasury Department. They've done a good job of doing investments, but maybe DAS can get together here with you and come back with a plan for how you'd like to deal with this. This property is hard to manage. Maybe some strange bits and pieces here that would be better off. Being a better asset for the public school, but if it was investment instead of land. So maybe we get together and have something come back to us.
And that's part of what we're looking at with the asset management plan, is to say, you know, what benchmark should we have for return on investment, and should, you know, are we better off investing in some of the land, or are we better off investing within the common school fund for stocks and bonds? Yes.
And with that, members, we're running a little bit over time here. So what I'll do is just make note for the committee members that we will be finishing the agency's presentation tomorrow. We'll also be taking public testimony in tomorrow's meeting. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5045 and adjourn this meeting, and we'll reconvene tomorrow at 1:00.